to the United Kingdom. 11 years since a Florida court heard he had sex with Virginia Jeffrey, aged 17. 10 years since a photograph of him appeared with his arms around the woman. 6 years since Jeffrey claimed he in fact raped her 3 times. And 10 days after the publication of Jeffrey's ghosted memoir, Nobody's Girl, the heat is on Prince Andrew to disappear, and for the monarchy, perhaps, to follow. Ian Dunt of the iPaper is here with the latest. Ian, how is the monarchy holding out?
Well, the monarchy itself is fine, really. I mean, there's no significant change in the manner in which it's viewed. But you can see the monarchy manages to endure because it is pretty good at spotting dangers before it gets to the point where, you know, they're affecting its credibility. The only gap there was during the death of Princess Diana, where things were so sort of fevered and hysterical that really they lost control of the narrative and they were in genuine danger at that moment. They very rarely are, and they're not now. But you can see why they're concerned. I mean, just a few hours ago, I was about to still call him Prince Charles. King Charles was out and about on a visit where one solitary protester sort of jumped up and started shouting about Andrew, why he was still being given money, why Parliament wasn't talking about it. The crowd then intervened and started, you know, 3 cheers for the king and blah, blah, blah. And that gives you a pretty good sort of distillation of where we're at, you know, in terms of the broad public view of the monarchy unchanged. But this sudden sense of uncertainty and volatility, particularly around this issue.
Will Andrew lose his home?
You're right. The imaginatively titled Royal Lodge, which is where he lives, with a sort of peppercorn token rent. I think it's becoming increasingly clear that something along those lines is going to happen. I mean, this is now, you're starting to hear questions from people like the Prime Minister. You're starting to hear questions in Parliament. You're starting to see that kind of sort of really quite bludgeoning press coverage day after day of front page headlines, zero tolerance really for any kind of moderation towards him whatsoever. And this is the current issue that it's mostly focused on. Like, will he be able to keep the Royal Lodge that he lives in? I think increasingly the answer looks like no, although the mechanisms by which you achieve that are quite hard to see. Ultimately, it would depend on the royal family probably taking action themselves.
So this is a big White House, 30 rooms in Windsor Great Park. I think under the flight path for Heathrow, isn't it?
I didn't know that.
Not perhaps as attractive as some might think. They've been trying to get him out of there for years, but Fergie lives there as well, which is sweet. And I've read reports, I don't know whether, Ian, these are true, that Fergie might accept shifting to somewhere called Adelaide Cottage, and Andrew might find himself somewhere called Frogmore Cottage in the same Windsor Great Park.
Yeah, these are these sort of, I mean, I suppose they'd be basically sort of hermitages within, you know, a larger royal estate, and that they would then be able to sort of be tucked out of the way there physically in the same way that they have been tucked out of the way symbolically. His case has not been helped by the publication of photos showing Epstein at that lodge, along with Weinstein. So it's almost like this sort of like league of the most sort of villainous figures of the last 10 years. And that makes the situation very, very hard to pertain. Like the royal family so far has managed to limit the damage by basically saying that we're just going to take away your ability to use your royal titles. He puts out a statement, Andrew puts out a statement saying, well, look, I mean, I've decided to do this of my own accord. I don't think anyone's under any illusions as to how that conversation will have gone or how much he genuinely chose to do it. Clearly, it's being forced on him. And at this stage now, there is quite evidently a lookout for what kind of, you know, housing situation can we just dump him in to take him out of the limelight to stop him being such a problem.
I think they're going to have to take the garter robes off him too, aren't they? I mean, that's just horrible. But the great embarrassment is family occasions, isn't it? I mean, state occasions, yes, they can keep him in a cupboard. But for christenings and weddings and funerals, there he is. He's so unattractive, Ian. He's such... It shouldn't count, should it? But yes, it shouldn't count. But you've written in the iPaper the other day that... This is not evidence of any kind of argument for getting rid of the monarchy in Britain.
No, it isn't. There's no popular support for that position. And nothing has really changed. in terms of the reason why it's kept, the arguments for getting rid of it have always been quite weak. I mean, they're progressive arguments. The weakest one of all of them is the question of priorities. Of just like, you know, there is just so much that is dreadfully wrong in this country. You wouldn't even put the monarchy in the top 40 of things that drastically need changing, predominantly because it doesn't really have any meaningful form of executive power. And while that pertains, you're obviously going to concern yourself much more with institutions which do have executive power and which have performed in an abysmal way over, well, not just the last 10 years, but much longer than that. So firstly, there's the question of priority. But secondly, I have to say, is a larger question, which I think, you know, from an Australian perspective, is quite interesting and quite telling, which is really what happens if you get rid of it, which of course was the, you know, which is what floundered during the referendum that you guys had on this issue. It wasn't so much, do you want to keep it? I didn't get the impression that people in Australia did particularly want to keep it. It was more, is there any support for an alternative system?
And what and sort of system do you have?
Well, exactly. And then the question is, okay, fine. So it's going to be democratic. Okay. Well, what happens then? And I mean, certainly in Britain right now, what happens then is that the head of state role would be sucked into the monstrous values-based culture war that we have everywhere else. It would be Nigel Farage for the reactionary right versus, you know, Green leader Zach Polanski for the sort of populist left shouting at each other about, you know, is immigration good or bad? And that would be the replacement. And the truth is, no matter where people are on that conversation or whether they're in it at all, they look at it and think, well, you know what, I wouldn't mind just having a sort of politics-free monarchy, even if it is on this insane ancient vestige of bloodline, rather than having that kind of bun fight. And on that basis, that question of what you replace it with, that's typically where any kind of conversations about republicanism just shatter on the shore.
Ian, just consider for a moment that we are commemorating the 50th anniversary of an incident where the Governor-General sacked an elected Prime Minister in this country with some considerable cooperation from Buckingham Palace. So your notion that, you know, there is no executive power, perhaps not in the United Kingdom, but we're rougher out here. And that notion of you know, deeply held monarchical power satisfies the imaginations of many Australians. But look, let's leave the monarchy for a moment, secure and able, and turn to Tory immigration policy. They really have brought honour on themselves, haven't they, with this new immigration policy?
It's almost, I mean, what's extraordinary about it is it's almost like they don't even know that they've done it. Well, in fact, they don't know that they've done it because we've seen, you know, there's conversations now with the leader of the Conservative Party and the spokesperson for the leader of the Conservative Party, and indeed the Shadow Home Secretary, where they show a deep ignorance as to the bill that they themselves have published and put in the public domain. It is by far the most, I mean, well beyond anything that the British National Party, a fascist party in the 1990s, was putting forward, much more extreme than that. The bill that they put forward earlier in the summer and only recently really discovered essentially says that people who have already been granted indefinite leave to remain, in other words, who have satisfied the legal requirements and have been allowed to stay here for as long as they like, essentially the step before citizenship, will now be deported if we decide that retrospectively they have broken conditions which we are currently going to apply but did not apply at the time that they were breaking them. Among those are, have they ever claimed any kind of benefit, including child maintenance payments, which, by the way, are basically given out to almost everyone in this country, and including state pension, which again would be above the level that they discuss. Have they been out of work and earning less than a certain amount for over 6 months? These criterias would see millions of deportations. And deportations, not just as, you know, people think of as immigrants, but people who are basically British families, you know, the spouses of British partners, British children themselves. You'd be tearing apart families and deporting them. It is much more extreme than what Donald Trump has been pursuing in the US, because at least ostensibly, those ICE quasi-military raids are against people who've broken immigration rules. They're not de facto charges against people who were legal migrants. And it is also much more extreme quantitatively than what Idi Amin did in Uganda, where the numbers were well below the millions that are being discussed here. Now, having written this bill, the Conservatives now seem almost shocked at the extent of what they themselves have proposed and seemingly now deny having written it, but they did write it. And it gives you an indication of just how corrosive that conversation has become in Britain.
Meanwhile, the Prime Minister seems to have loser tattooed on his forehead.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very brutal description, but it's not necessarily an incorrect one. Coming in at 11% in the Caerphilly by-election last week, a by-election in Wales. Wales is the proper homeland of Labour. It's, you know, with some of the most famous figures in Labour history, including Nye Bevan, the creator of the NHS, and Neil Kinnock, former leader of the Labour Party, have come from. Absolutely hammered to 11% in a race that was won, fascinatingly, by Plaid Cymru. Plaid Cymru, a Welsh independence party that wants to separate from the UK. Welsh independence has never had very much success in Wales or anywhere else.
It's a great issue. I mean, for Wales to reclaim its nationhood after how many centuries? But anyway, we'll look more closely into that in a moment. This little corner of Wales, a Labour stronghold held for more than a century by Labour, very, very white, a former coal mining area. And now they've turned to Welsh independence.
Well, OK, so here's the thing. I don't think that that's happened. I think what's happened here is an astonishing speed of change in two-party politics, from Labour against the Conservatives to Reform against Plaid Cymru. Now, Reform, it's that hard right party led by Nigel Farage, very anti-immigration. And once it's talked about more often, and it is the centre of almost all political conversations over here right now, the great populist wave at the gates, the barbarians at the gates, then what happens is the progressive forces as just consolidating around whoever there is to go to. The crucial thing to look at is it's not just the Labour vote. Look at the Green vote in that seat, down to 1.5%. Look at the Liberal Democrat vote in that seat, down to 1.5%. Look at the Tory vote when you look at the consolidation of the right-wing vote, down to 2%. What's happening there is essentially Reform voters who really like them flooding to the party on the populist right, and progressive voters going for anyone who can defeat them. And suddenly, with astonishing speed, Labour and the Conservatives, who have owned politics for over 100 years, I mean, the Conservatives, for, you know, centuries before that, suddenly being replaced by these new brands. In different seats, it obviously won't be Plaid Cymru. It'll be the Green Party that can consolidate, or it'll still be Labour, it'll still be the Lib Dems. But suddenly you're getting this insight into a very different, very new kind of British politics fought by different parties on completely new terrain.
And in less than a minute, can you explain what Sir Keir Starmer plans to do about it?
No, I don't think I can. I don't think anyone knows at this point. He does some things that are terribly wonderful. He did a great conference speech, you know, a few weeks ago, calling out Reform for being racist. Then the rest of the time, he'll come out and equivocate and sort of justify some of these extremist policies that we see from Reform. I don't think they have a narrative or a strategy. And, you know, things would significantly improve if they did. I cannot stress enough how urgent it is that they do so.
Ian, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.